This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to get you an honorary degree in bubbleology with our salute to fizzy drinks like champagne and beer and a party trick based on a little chemistry knowledge. But first, are you a little stir-crazy after all the holiday feasting? Yeah, you tired of roasting chestnuts on an open fire? Well, how about getting outside? Because I've got the perfect scavenger hunt for you. You'll need a notebook, a sharp set of eyes, maybe bring binoculars if you got them. Your mission? Try to spot as many of the planet's 10,000 species of birds as you can, or modern-day dinosaurs, as the American Museum of Natural History calls them. Bands of bird nerds have been scanning the skies all over the country, around the world even, for the 117th annual Christmas Bird Count, a global census of birds. And there is 1 week left, so you don't have to be left out. My next guests have both been part of that count. They're here to tell us how it's going and answer your questions, too. Maybe you spotted something you can't ID. We've got a couple of experts who might help you out. Give us a call, 844-724-8255, or you can tweet us at SciFry. Jeff LeBaron is Christmas Bird Count Director at the National Audubon Society in Northampton, Massachusetts. He joins us from New England Public Radio today. Welcome back, Jeff.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me again, Ira.
You know, I counted you. I think you hold the record for the most times. We counted 13 years you have been coming back and forth, even including your 100th anniversary show.
I was trying to remember when I first started. I know it was when I was still down in the New York office, and I went down to the studios, and I was in studio with you then.
Yeah. It's been a long and fruitful relationship. Also with us is Deborah Krinsky, conservation biologist at the New York City Audubon. She joins us here in the studios at CUNY. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Let's talk about what's going on. But before we listen, before we begin, we have a special quiz for the birders out there. I'm going to play a clip of a bird call and see if you can identify it. Now, it's a bird that has nearly disappeared from the Christmas bird counts in the mid-1900s, but it is now much more widespread and increasing in numbers around the country. I'm going to play the sound of a success story. This is the sound. Okay, that was the sound. If you know what it is, our number 844-724-8255, or you can tweet us at SciFry. It is not a seagull. We'll let you know what it is after a while when people start calling in. Deborah, you were on the Central Park count here in New York City. What did you discover?
Yes, so we always have some really great sightings here in Central Park and all over New York City, but in the Central Park count, we had a few highlights. We had an Iceland gull, American widgeon, a northern pintail that had been hanging out for a few days, and then also probably our most exciting sighting was a killdeer, which is a shorebird that was found in the northeast part of Central Park. So just an unusual bird to have around in Manhattan this time of year.
Where would it normally be found if it were?
Normally, so these birds tend to be along coasts, but they do like lawns and gravel, so they can be found in parking lots, on golf courses, so that's pretty unusual in itself too, but to see one in Central Park in December is pretty neat.
Now, a lot of people think that, well, urban parks can't have a lot of birds in them, right? Whether here or San Francisco or wherever else.
Yeah, people get really surprised when I tell them I work at New York City Audubon. Oh, you just have pigeons and starlings and house sparrows. But we actually have a really amazing diversity of birds here in New York City. And even in our really small parks, our pocket parks, we get a lot of birds. So, for example, in Bryant Park, this relatively small park in Midtown Manhattan.
Right next door.
There's a ton of birds that can be seen there year-round. And this year, during the Christmas bird count, we had a Lincoln sparrow. So a pretty unusual bird for this time of year in this area as well. So you never know what's going to pop up. That's why it's important we got to count all the parks.
Now, speaking of counting, Jeff, how are the counts going this year? See anything unusual?
I think they're going very well. We're still early in the process of data entry. I just checked this afternoon, and there are about 250 counts entered so far. which is about a tenth of where we'll be at the end. But the interesting thing this year has been a pretty significant effect that the weather is going to have on the overall count, I believe, because with the holidays on the weekends, most of the counts try to be conducted during the weekend themselves. And so the first weekend of the count period was when everybody had the whole weekend, and sort of on a continental basis, there was some pretty unpleasant weather. So we'll see how it goes. But sometimes the weather actually brings things out and makes us, lets us find some pretty interesting stuff. I was on a count in Rhode Island this past Monday, and we found a couple of very unusual birds, a northern water thrush, which is a third record for the South Kingstown Christmas count. And we also found a western tanager, which is a first count record. It's a bird that shouldn't be here at all, let alone at this season.
Now, why do you think it would be there? What would, you know, why?
Well, this was a hatchier bird. It was a young bird. And for any migratory species, there's sort of some small percentage of the birds that are going to go 90 or 180 degrees in the wrong direction during migration. And so for a bird that's breeding in the, you know, western U.S., if it heads east instead of south, it'll end up here. Mm. But also, there's been a series of strong storms that have swept right across from the Pacific Northwest over here, and that can also bring birds over. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how that bird fares. But
let's see what our listeners have found. Let's go to Becky in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Becky.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I live in Dubuque, and we live like on a 5-acre farm. It's in the city, so we see a lot of birds here. And there are three bluebirds that are hanging around this winter. We see them in the spring. They come, a pair of them usually shows up, and then we don't usually see them the rest of the season. And now there's three of them staying here. Seemed kind of weird to me.
Yeah, Jeff.
Bluebirds are one of those species that have actually expanded their range northward quite a bit over the last 50 years, and you can sort of track that looking at Christmas count data. We're also interested, Audubon is very interested in seeing what's going on with bluebirds. We have a new program called Climate Watch, which we're testing out right now, and it's actually looking for areas where bluebirds are moving into during the winter in the north and probably out of in the south. So it's sort of trying to track how the birds are responding to climate change. And it's very interesting what the bluebirds are doing in terms of being further north and also more inland in the north.
Deborah, I know there are certain birds that birders sort of look down on, the little brown bird, right, the LBBs. They're mm-hmm. considered too boring. Is the bird count about spotting rare species, or do these boring birds count also?
Everything counts. So I think it's important to count the common birds while they're still common, because then you can tell, are there changes over time in those populations? Mm-hmm. And it's still pretty exciting, even if you get a high count of a really common bird. For example, we had in Central Park 1,300 white-throated sparrows. So they're an abundant bird this time of year, but gosh, that's a lot of sparrows. And it was really fun counting them all throughout the park. So it's really important.
You know, a couple of years ago, way up in a tree, I mean, this has got to be a 100-foot tree, there was a giant bird up there that I thought had to be a turkey vulture. Mm-hmm. Now, in chatting with you, you said, no, it's probably a turkey itself all the way up there?
Yep, they can fly. You don't think that looking at them, because they're these really weighty birds, but they can get pretty high. And I've seen them myself fly all the way from the ground in my backyard all the way up to a tall tree, and I thought, wow, I didn't even realize they could fly that high or fly at all. But it's really, really amazing, those birds.
They're very impressive when they fly, and they actually roost in trees at night, so it's really something to see a flock of them both take off and also come down out of the trees.
Mm. Yeah, because I've seen them flocking and flying maybe 10 feet above the ground, but I didn't realize they could go that high. Wow. Let's go to the phones to Orlando. Kathy, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hey, I was on an Audubon bird count, and I saw something blue, like really blue. And, I mean, I knew it was a bird. I didn't know what it was. And a real birder stayed with it, and it was an indigo bunting. Mm. And they didn't count it because we didn't have a picture of it. But a real birder said it was an indigo bunting, so I guess not every bird gets counted, but
well, you just
but I knew it was there.
You just informally filed it. See that with the bird count.
We always try to. It's just certainly it sounds like it probably, and especially down in Florida, it could have been an indigo bunting. They do winter some places down there, and so do the painted buntings, the real multicolored ones.
Well, I'm going to play before the break. I'm going to play the bird sound one more time. We asked you at the beginning of the program if you knew what this sound was. We're getting a lot of answers in, so let me replay it if you just are joining us now. What is that bird sound? We've got a lot of people. We'll go away for the break in a couple of minutes. We'll come back. We'll talk about that sound. Jeff, did you want to say something? I heard you.
Well, I wanted to sort of latch on to what Deborah said a few minutes ago. The rare birds are the things that sort of bring birders out. It's the sort of catalyst that gets us out there. But the real meat and potatoes of the Christmas bird count is, are the common birds, as she mentioned in it. The beauty of the CBC is that we really are getting a yardstick on everything that's out there on a continental basis at the same time of year, and we can actually really track what's happening over time with a lot of the species. So it is a meaningful database that's been generated for the last 117 years, and it's been a real treat and honor to be in charge of it. It's been 29 years for me now. So
how did they get started? It's over 117 years. Well, how did it get started?
It started as Frank Chapman actually began the count back in 1900. He proposed to do a Christmas bird count instead of a Christmas bird hunt. There was a growing awareness of the need for conservation back then, and the Audubon movement was beginning as well. And so every year since then, and in fact Central Park has been covered every year since 1900 in the Christmas bird count. And the real beauty of the data is that we're collecting effort data as well as the bird data, so that we can, in a year like this, where potentially weather is impacting the number of people that are out there and how they can get around, it's still valuable data because we're sort of tracking birds per party hour. We can sort of measure how much effort was expended to actually count all the birds that are tallied every year.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break, come back, and talk more about the Christmas bird count with what you've seen, too, with Deborah, who's a Kriansky? Kriansky is a conservation biologist at New York City Audubon. Jeff LeBaron, Christmas Bird Count Director for the National Audubon Society. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're taking our census of feathery flyers this hour with our checkup on the annual Christmas Bird Count with my guest, Deborah Kriansky, conservation biologist at New York City Audubon, Jeff LeBaron, Christmas Bird Count Director for the National Audubon Society. And as you know, it tends to be the big animals, the birds, the whales, the wildebeest, that get all the attention for their migrations. But there are also huge armies of insects, dragonflies, butterflies, and so on. I'm talking about trillions of them migrating overhead, and joining me to talk about that is Jessica Ware. She's associate professor at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. She joins us via Skype. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sure that a lot of people don't realize just the amount of insects that are flying over our heads.
It's true, actually. It's something that I like to think about. It makes me excited. There's probably trillions of insects flying above us at any one time.
Well, there was research published last week saying something like thousands of tons of insects are flying over our heads.
That's remarkable. Jason Chapman's group has published a couple of papers, one in 2010 and one last week, that suggests that there might be, 3.5 trillion insects or 3,200 tons of insects above our heads kind of at any one time. And that's exciting to think about.
Is this a seasonal thing or just sort of when they feel like it?
Well, there's different types of migration that happens in insects. Some things are seasonal, things like Pentala flavescens, which is a dragonfly that migrates across the Indian Ocean and perhaps across other oceans as well. That seems to go with a pattern that kind of follows rainy seasons. Then there are other insects like monarch butterflies, which tend to be more seasonal. And then there are other insects that just kind of use wind currents and kind of opportunistically get blown from here to there, hither to thunder.
and you're studying this dragonfly, and it flies over the ocean without stopping?
That's true. So although I think a lot of the birders who are listening right now, they like to think about their birds traveling long distances, and they feel pretty great about their migration. But I'm here to give a pitch for Pantella flavescens, which, as far as we know, seems to be able to travel 18,000 kilometers as a single individual. And that's a remarkable distance. We know that they can cross the Indian Ocean. And there have been plenty of people who have recorded them, and you know, big swarms, hundreds of thousands of them, kind of stopping over in the Maldives. It's really quite remarkable.
Wow. Do any of the bird migrants hook up with the insect swarms and sort of have lunch, you know, in the air there?
Most definitely. I mean, there are lots of insectivorous birds out there, and dragonflies make a great food source. They have a lot of flight muscle, they have some fat, so I think that they would be a really good food source. Any bird that came across these migrating swarms of Pantella, I suppose, would want to exploit that food source. Other things that we know of that are, we kind of think of as being migratory, things like monarch butterflies, which travel in, you know, large groups, multi-generational migrations down to Mexico, those actually can be toxic. So there's actually only a couple of birds that are known to consume them, because that's part of the whole monarch warning coloration. They consume milkweed, and they can be quite distasteful to birds.
Well, that's quite informative. We have to have a new respect for all those insect migrations, Jessica. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Jessica Ware, Associate Professor at Rutgers University. Still with me are our bird spotters, Deborah Kriansky, Conservation Biologist at New York City Audubon, Jeff LeBaron, Christmas Bird Count Director for the National Audubon Society. Did you know about all those insects?
I knew about some of them, yeah. The monarchs especially.
Yeah.
A friend of mine studies dragonflies also, and I know there are some long-distance migrant dragonflies here too. And quite a few of the butterfly species do migrations in the Americas.
Oh.
It's really very interesting.
It is. Let me play our mystery sound bird call one more time, and then we'll give away what the answer is. Let's hear it. Okay, we've had lots of responses. Let's go to Sue in Sterling, Alaska. Hi, Sue.
Hi.
Have you got a guess for us?
It's an eagle.
What kind of eagle?
Bald eagle.
Ding, ding, ding. I wish I had a little dinger to get. Yes, that's the correct. That's the correct. Didn't fool you, did it?
Not at all.
In fact, I was looking at our tweets coming in, speaking of birds, and almost 90% of the people who tweeted in all knew that it was a bald eagle. I know. When I heard it, what do I know? I'm a city kid. I had no idea. Deborah, you're smiling.
Yeah, it's funny, in film and TV, they often replace the call of bald eagles with red-tailed hawks. So
Stephen Colbert,
don't,
you know,
them.
At the beginning of his show, I thought that's what a bald eagle sounded like. No. Well, I wish I could had a prize for you, but I don't. So thanks for calling in. I guess she's gone. Yeah, you know, it's true. A lot of people, Jeff, would think that a bald eagle has a great big sound.
Yeah, so I think for non-birders, but you know, people in Alaska have a little heads up or leg up, because there never were any problems with the eagle populations in Alaska, and they're quite, I mean, it's not maybe quite the right thing to say, but they're literally trash birds. They'll congregate by the hundreds in dumps, like gulls do here in, you know, the Northeast. So it is a real conservation success story on a continental basis of the reintroduction efforts for bald eagle, and it's really, they've been removed from the endangered species list, and it's really nice to have some successes out there.
And we've been seeing them here in New York City more and more, which is super exciting. We get a lot of calls, people spotting them. That can't be a bald eagle. Nope, it probably is. So it's very exciting.
Do they live in the bridges and ledges, or are they in trees? Or
mostly in trees, yeah, around lakes and near the water.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see if let's see if we can go to the phones. Let's go to Keaton in North Idaho. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Hey there.
Hi, I just was sitting here listening to you guys on the radio, and I work for a nonprofit here in North Idaho called Birds of Prey Northwest. I heard the bald eagle come over the radio, and I thought it might have been one of my own, but it turns out I needed to call in and tell you guys what it was.
Do you take care of bald eagles?
Yeah. We run a nonprofit where we do rescue and rehabilitation on all sorts of birds of prey. So we have educational birds on the site that we take to schools and show them to kids. And then we also have several eagles we have in rehabilitation right now.
Well, good for you. Thanks for calling and have a happy holiday.
Thank you, you guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, their raptor rehab is very big, isn't it?
Yeah, we have a place here in Manhattan called the Wild Bird Fund that we have a lot of birds get sent there. We get a lot of birds that collide with glass windows and buildings. So that's a pretty big issue here, and so we really depend on our local rehabbers for those birds.
Jeff, did you want to...
Yeah, the rehabbers also, many of them do have education centers, and like the Colorado and Idaho mentioned, and it's a wonderful opportunity for school groups and other people to sort of have a up close and personal experience with a bird of prey that otherwise they might only be able to glimpse at a distance, and it can be a especially for the birds that can't be released back into the wild. It can be really almost life changing to some people to suddenly have that sort of aha moment with a bird of prey or any other bird being rehabbed up close and personal.
You know, Jeff, you've been with me for so many years. You hear me whine every year on this program about not having seen a hummingbird in my backyard. Well, I am here to report success to you this summer. When I put
congratulations.
Up, I put up a hummingbird feeder and watched it carefully, grew all the right plants, and one of our listeners sent me some beautiful red seeds, actually, to plant, said it would guarantee me getting hummingbirds, and then maybe it had something to do with it. And sure enough, and as I watched, I couldn't believe how voracious the hummingbirds are at drinking the nectar.
They
are
amazing
drain this
to
thing.
Watch, yeah.
They're just incredible, and they're very, very feisty also. But Audubon also has a program called Hummingbirds at Home, where you can actually the goal of that is actually to track what food sources the hummingbirds are using in people's yards. So if you have the hummingbird, you're probably going to have it for every year, and in increasing numbers as long as they can nest around your yard. So you'll have them for a good long time, I suspect.
Yeah, I saw them going into some of the shrubs and hanging out there and then going back to the feeder. But I was afraid to go near them. And then as I got closer and closer, they let me come up to them, which is great.
They can be very confiding around the feeders, especially.
All right, let's see if we get a lot of folks want to talk. Let's go to Deborah in Wisconsin. Hi, Deborah. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira and bird people. I have an owl. I call it my owl every night when I'm out, which hasn't been lately because it's so cold. But he's out there, and he or she, and it's like it's not the usual owl that I heard in the past. And I think it's a screech owl, but it's like one instead of hoo, 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 it's like so, and one night, one morning, I saw it actually in a tree, swooping down. And it's white and with brown specks. And I'm pretty sure it was the owl, not the hawk, that I see, because it was just huge.
Wow!
I wanted to mention killdeer. We have a street named after killdeer. I love them. I just love them. And they nest near the railroad tracks here. So I'm very interested in that killdeer you mentioned.
Yeah, they're great.
Could that have been a locomotive coming by that next to your railroad track? That you heard?
Nope. I put pennies down for that and go collect them. I know what the trade sounds like. But.
All right, let me ask our experts. Jeff, you have any idea what kind of owl that might have been?
Well, if it was big, it probably wasn't a screech owl. It might have been something, you might have a barred owl, B-A-R-R-E-D owl, instead of a great horned, if that's the ones that they usually have, the great big guys with the ear tufts. But other owls do move, and I mean there's a thing called a long-eared owl, short-eared owl, things like that, and then some much smaller owls as well. But the screech owl has a sort of a whinny; it doesn't sound like your typical owl noise. So I wonder if it might have been more something like a barred owl or even a long-eared.
Hmm. That's great that you can hear it, Deborah. Thanks for calling in. While we're on the subject of owls, let's go to Todd in San Rafael, California. Hi, Todd.
I was just going to say my story is about an owl as well. Mine is about some burrowing owls that live in an open space across from my brother-in-law's house in Brentwood, California, which is about an hour east of where I live in San Rafael, which is just north of San Francisco. And I have a great I took some great pictures that allowed me to get really close. And my brother-in-law had some information about them. And he said, we were just there at Christmas again, and I saw one. And he said, wow, I'm really surprised because they would be, he didn't think they'd be around at this time.
Hmm. Yeah, it shouldn't be there. What do you say, Jeff?
They do move to some extent in the winter, especially the northern populations. But the burrowing owls, I used to live in New Mexico, and we had burrowing owls in Albuquerque when I was there. And they're one of the most engaging and fun. Of course, they're active in the daytime, so you get to see them more than a lot of the other owls. But they're a very interesting conservation story because they are at risk because they actually need prairie dog burrows because they can't dig their own burrows. So they sort of rely on prairie dog towns and other ground squirrels and things like that. But they are really, really wonderful birds to have around.
Let's tell you who we are. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Deborah Kriensky and Jeff LeBaron. Lots of tweets came in. Let's see if we can go through some of the tweets. Nathan Brazil says, it is awesome in Anchorage when if it gets below zero and all the gnarly raven come down from the hills to examine everything. That's kind of cool. Crystal Chavez says, Florida is home to one of the largest bald eagle breeding populations in the continental U.S. Mama Java says, best sighting was a pair of eastern bluebirds nesting in our backyard. Yeah, it's great. So people really love birds and bird watching. You know, I was not a big bird watcher up until about 10 years ago when I went to the Everglades, and I was just blown away by the birds I saw, Deborah. There. It was amazing.
Yeah, I actually started bird watching maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and Everglades is one of the first places where I was just astounded by the bird life and said, oh gosh, I really want to know what all these birds are. And that was one of the things that got me hooked.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, what's the best way if you want to start watching birds to do it?
Just really look around you. I think birds are sort of the one relatively visible animal that almost any human on Earth can see. With the possible exception of researchers at South Pole Station. But even, you know, anywhere in the desert, out in the middle of the ocean, birds are just around. So really, even in cities, I mean, certainly, as Deborah mentioned, you know, a place like Central Park, it has a sort of an island effect and can be an incredible diversity of birds, especially during migration in city parks or just a green backyard. So they're in your yards, they come into bird feeders, so it's just... notice what's out there, and if you're interested, it can chickadee or even watching pigeons can be very interesting when you start to realize how much variation there is in the different plumage, and it's likely that something will pique your interest. You'll notice a little bit more, and then you'll notice that one's a little different, and sort of it grows from there.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, are people always joining or looking for members?
Oh yeah, we always. Love getting new members. We have bird walks, classes, all sorts of fun events.
Even
citizen
in the winter
science.
Time?
Yep, we've got lots of things going on in the winter. Winter bird walk. So if you're up for a challenge in a little bit of cold weather, we're the place.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, when is the deadline? When is the bird watch over? The national.
Well, the last day of this season's Christmas bird count is January 5th. And then people will be entering all their results and everything sort of through February or so. But there's, in addition to Audubon chapters, there's all sorts of other bird organizations. There's bird clubs and, other conservation and birding organizations around if you want to sort of learn more and join in. Or a lot of online resources, too.
So let me see if I can get a quick call in from Tom in Port Orange, Florida. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead.
Good. Yeah, I just wanted to share something that was quite spectacular one time. I'm an avid fisherman. I live in East Central Florida, and we have a lot of ospreys. But we in this particular area, which is near brackish water, there's not as many bald eagles. But at any rate...
Got to hurry up. We're running out of time.
At any rate, a osprey caught a fish, and it was leaving to go... take it to its nest or whatever, and out of nowhere this bald eagle came like a jet fighter and stole the fish from the osprey out of its talons. And the interesting thing was that the osprey really did not do anything but screech, and the eagle went off with the fish. So it was the description really doesn't do it justice, but it was quite spectacular.
Wow. Yeah, picture's worth a thousand words. Thank our guests, Deborah Kriensky, conservation biologist at New York City Audubon, Jeff LeBaron, Christmas Bird Count Director for the National Audubon Society. 13th time is a charm. We'll see you next year, I hope, Jeff. And you too, Deborah. Thank you both, and have a happy holidays weekend.
Thank you. You too.
After the break, get ready to pop a bottle in the name of science. Of course, we'll be talking about fizzy drinks. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know the sound of the pop of the cork and the pouring of the champagne down the side of a glass? Are you mindful of how you pour it? Do you pour it down the side? Maybe you pour it straight in? Does it really matter? Well, you bet it does, especially if you're a foam aficionado. Those who go through the trouble to learn all about the bubble want to know what causes the foam to form. Want to know why the bubbles in beer are different from those in sparkling wine or seltzer? And they want an answer to the age-old question. How do you store leftover champagne? What's the best way to keep it for the next morning? Are you one of these people who want to know these things? Well, for the rest of the hour, we sort the fizzy fact from fiction with bubbleologists waiting to answer your questions. Dick Zare is professor in the chemistry department at Stanford University in California. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Indeed, I'm a bubble watcher as well as a bird watcher.
What do you find most fascinating about bubbles?
They are really different in different liquids. For example, you see that bubbles in seltzer rise much more rapidly than they do in champagne, and champagne is faster than they are in beer.
Wow.
And this really comes from the fact that the bubbles get coated with organic matter, with proteins and peptides that are in the medium. Hmm. Of course, seltzer water tends to be pure, and that's why they rise the fastest. The others coat it and tend to slow it down.
Mm-hmm.
I also make a more viscous liquid.
I also noted from your research that the bubbles in some beer actually go downward. They circle the glass.
They can. You can see that when you for example, pour yourself a Guinness beer. Initially, they tend to go down on the sides of the glass, but they are going up in the center. What's happening is you're getting a circulation of liquid, and that circulation is actually more rapid than the rate at which the bubbles rise. So that they actually go down to your eye.
Wow. Let me also bring on Charlie Bamforth, Distinguished Professor of Malting and Brewing Sciences at the UC Davis. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Nice to be back with you.
Nice to have you. Charlie, let's start at the beginning. Where do the bubbles form inside a glass? Why don't I see them in unopened bottles of beer or champagne, for example?
Well, beer, for example, and champagne, they're supersaturated solutions. So of carbon dioxide, the bubbles don't form spontaneously unless there's something present, which is a nucleation site. And these nucleation sites can be various things. They may be other bubbles, or they may be scratches or notches, deliberately etched notches in the bottom of glasses and so on. But simple agitation as well will disturb the carbon dioxide and bring it out of solution.
Hmm.
So the worst thing in the world you can do, in my opinion, is to pour a beer ever so gently down the side of a glass. That is criminal, because you won't actually produce the foam.
Hmm. Dick Zare, you actually made a perfectly smooth glass to test out this idea that what happens when the bubbles have nowhere to form.
Indeed. I used the chemical coating on one of the glasses to show that you could suppress the bubbling action. And I must tell you, people don't like that. One of the reasons for drinking champagne, anyways, is to feel the tiny bubbles on your lips and tongue. And people like that sensation. And if you don't have them popping.
Right. We actually have the video of that up on our website at sciencefriday.com/bubbles. Charlie, do different beers have different levels of carbonation? And is that done on purpose?
Yes, they do. I mean, the lowest carbonation is likely to be on a cask-conditioned ale in my native England. And there you might have only about 2.5 grams per litre of carbon dioxide. The most famous beer style that's highest in carbonation tends to be a Hefeweizen, and that's going to be over 6 grams per litre of carbon dioxide. But I would imagine that's still considerably less than you would get in a champagne.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255 if you're an amateur bubbleologist and want to talk about the bubbly you might be drinking this weekend. Dick, does the shape of the glass matter? Should I drink champagne out of a flute or a larger glass? Or is the same thing as far as the bubbles are concerned?
Well, no, it does matter again. And if your shape of your glass is flaring out, you won't get this action of getting circulation of bubbles going down. It does matter in that sense. And you also are very much involved with the aroma. And so the shape of various liquid containers depends on what liquid you put inside them as to how pleasing they are.
Hmm.
You know that from a brandy glass or snifter to something else.
So if you use those wide glasses, will it bubble out faster? Will it not stay as fizzy as long? Is this for
the
flute?
The bubbles, as Charlie explained to you, Professor Banforth, that they form on the sides and the bottoms of the glass, on imperfections, on things that are left behind.
And
of course, if you have less surface area for volume, you get less bubbles altogether.
Right. Now, we all know that when you take a carbonated beverage of any kind and you pour it into a glass, Charlie, with ice in it, it really just foams up a lot. Why does that happen?
Yeah. Well, again, you've got the nucleation site phenomenon. But on the subject of glasses, people say, what's the right glass for the right beer? I said, it's the one that's not got the wrong name on it. That's stage one. So you don't want one brand of beer in a beer glass that's got somebody else's entire name on it. And the other thing is, it's got to be clean. And in my experience, I used to be a quality assurance manager for a major brewing company in the UK. In my experience, 99% of problems with bubbles are nothing to do with the liquid. It's how they're poured, or indeed if they're poured into a dirty glass. And
careful,
much effort needs to go into the actual presentation. It's not the brewer's fault usually. It's the dispense that's at fault.
If your cleaning leaves some soap solution behind, you'll find that it kills the bubbles.
Really?
What I always say is, clean the glasses first. If you fill a sink with hot water and detergent, do the glasses first and make sure that the detergent is rinsed away, and ideally drain. Let them drain dry, and don't try and wipe them with anything, because there's a risk of introducing grease or dirt from the cloth, but also your fingers are going to have grease on them, and never carry glasses with your fingers inserted into them. That's disgusting.
There's a common trick at bars that people rub their nose and pick up grease and then put it into the head of beer and make it disappear.
That's horrific. That's criminal. That's
just
terrible.
Ruined my next glass of beer.
But something like this actually happens on New Year's Eve in a way that you should pay attention to. If you watch men and women sipping champagne, you'll find that women generally have less bubbles in their champagne than men.
Because?
Viva la difference.
Because?
Okay, the difference is lips. What type of lips? Lips that have lipstick. The lipstick, again, is a grease that breaks apart bubbles. Now, I have to warn you, what I've just told you does have exceptions. Just as you can have secondhand smoke, you can get secondhand lipstick. So some men will also leave less bubbles.
Wow.
And the other problem is with men, those who've got mustaches and so on, there's great globules of grease that are swinging on the whiskers and dripping into the foam, and that doesn't do it any good either,
Yeah.
But never have a mustache and lipstick at the same time, because that really would kill the foam.
Yeah. I hate it when that happens. Let's go to Washington, D.C. with Brian. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, love your show.
Thank you.
I also happen to love Guinness. And while it's best in a pint in a pub, I often get the cans. And I would love to hear you talk about the widget and how it creates the head on top of the pint. And I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay. Charlie?
Well, the widget is simply a nucleation device. It's basically a lump of plastic with a hole in it. And the beer is packed under pressure. And in that can, there's not only carbon dioxide, there's also some nitrogen gas as well. And nitrogen is not very soluble, and it won't go from bubble to bubble, so the bubbles last longer, so it stabilizes the foam. So when you open a can of Guinness, you hear a shh sort of noise, and that is you can hear the bubbles being produced. And basically, they're being nucleated using from that widget. The problem with it, in my opinion, is that you've got to chill the beer down. You really got to serve it from a refrigerator. If you try to do that with a can of Guinness at room temperature, when you open it, you're just going to shower foam everywhere, and you're going to get your pants wet. And Guinness, of course, is traditionally not supposed to be consumed at refrigerated temperature. So to me, it's a design flaw. But nonetheless, people are very fond of it. So it really is an exercise in serving Guinness at home, just as you would have it in the bar. In the bar, it's dispensed under a mixture of carbon dioxide and nitrogen. But the widget is just a nucleation device.
Let me go in the opposite direction. I have one of these soda makers at home. You use carbon dioxide. You inject it into the bottle of water. Does one temperature of water work better, hold more CO2 than any other temperature? What temperature should I try to dissolve it in, Dick?
Cold. Indeed. Cold water holds gases much more than hot water, warm water. In fact, you can see this as water gets warm in a glass. You can often watch bubbles form on the outside if it's picked up a lot of gas in the meantime. And this really tells you what you should do to preserve champagne that's been opened. You got to, as soon as you can, make it cold again, so that stops it from going flat.
Yeah, I remember, was it you who did experiments years ago to determine what's the best way to keep an open bottle?
Yes.
Viable? And what did you discover?
We discovered that the use of a silver spoon wasn't all that effective. People talked about putting a silver spoon in the neck of the bottle, other than that if you put it back in the refrigerator, it helps to cool the bottle down. The thing you want to do is keep it cold. And if you keep it cold, you can keep it actually for like a day, and it still doesn't go flat.
No need
to. That's slow when you really make it cold.
No need to cork it. Just leave it open in the refrigerator.
It actually changes its flavor in time, and some people like the change in flavor when it's been aged a bit. It's like aerating a wine.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with two bubble scientists, Charlie Bamforth, Distinguished Professor of Malting and Brewing Sciences. I don't think we've ever had anybody with that title. And UC Davis, Dick Zaire, Professor in the Chemistry Department at Stanford University. Charlie, do you have your own method or favorite method of keeping the champagne for the next day?
Well, first of all, I don't keep champagne. I only have beer in the house. The second thing is, in my opinion, you should open a container and consume it, whether it's yourself or shared amongst friends, without trying to store it. So most bottles of beer are a reasonable size, and that's entirely in keeping. But no, once a bottle of beer is open or a can of beer is open, then it's best to consume it.
Yeah. Let's go to Anthony in Des Moines. Hi, Anthony.
Hello, Ira. Thank you for having me on.
Go ahead, Red. You're welcome.
So I have a question for your bubbleologists. I work at a bar, and we serve some nitrogen-infused beers. And these beers, no matter how hard we try, we cannot pour them into our chilled mugs, else they overflow. I'm wondering why this is and if there is any way to pour these so that they will not overflow.
Okay, good question. Dick, do you want to take that first, and I'll go to Charlie?
Well, I think I would tell you again, that if you want to stop it from overflowing, that you actually do want to pour it gently on the side and not to stir it up.
That's fighting words for Charlie, though.
That's right.
You know, I'll take us to Dublin, and there, if you go and have a Guinness, that Guinness, as I've said, contains nitrogen, and it's dispensed under a mixture of carbon dioxide and nitrogen. And the key is patience. So if you go and order a Guinness in Dublin, you've got to wait at least 10 minutes And what you'll get, first of all, is a glass full of foam, and it will, the liquid will drain away, and the proteins and the bitter acids in the foam will stick together, and they'll give you a start to stabilize the foam, and then progressively you top it up. So and there's a leisurely pouring experience you'll get in other countries in Europe as well. So I think the secret is to remember the fact that some beers, depending on their composition, are very foamable, and you've simply got to be patient and dispense them slowly.
Okay, I think that says a lot about that. Let's go to Cincinnati, and Dave, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
You'll have to forgive me for varying from the sacrament of beer here into soda. My question was about, is there a difference between glass-bottled soda and plastic in soda as far as bubbles goes? Seems like maybe there's more nucleation points in plastic. I don't know if that's true or not. It just feels like it.
Good question. Charlie?
Well, I don't study soda, so I can't really comment on that. I think that's probably a better question.
Dick?
Question for Dick.
I have not myself looked into this issue, but I think, again, you can make both of those very smooth surfaces. I don't know, in terms of commercial manufacturing, which turns out to be smoother.
Can we make that experiment that you did at home, making the glass totally smooth, watching it happen?
You can, but I'm not going to recommend it because I don't want to introduce other chemicals into something that somebody might drink.
Should you dishwash your glasses if you want to drink the beer?
You can do that, and indeed, if you add just a little bit of detergent, you will kill the bubbles, as I mentioned.
All right. Any last-second advice for our imbibers for them this holiday season?
Oh, enjoy.
All right. Don't let them hang around till the next day. Charlie Bamforth, Distinguished Professor of Malting and Brewing Science at the University of California, UC Davis, and Dick Zier, Professor in the Chemistry Department at Stanford University in California.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Thank you both. If you want to see a video of what happens with a perfect glass, you can't. Not to make your own, where no bubbles can form. Head over to sciencefriday.com/bubbles to check it out. I'm going to check that right out. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. We are going to say goodbye for this year. If you want to write us, send letters to email scifry@sciencefriday.com or the old-fashioned classic way, Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, Room 412, New York, New York, 10036. Have a very happy new year, a safe one, too. We'll see you in 2017. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.